Chapter 8, Allo AIDS for AIDS. To date, there are no acknowledged cures for AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, but some contenders for arrest and remission have definitely emerged. Leading the way are a number of treatments involving aloe vera and derivatives from the plant's innate chemical matrix. Before we delve into a fully detailed analysis of AIDS and what new breakthroughs may have been made in the search for the cure, we feel it is almost essential first to examine the human immune system and what causes it to function the way it does. Because it is only through understanding this highly complex network of cells, phagocytes, lymphocytes, leukocytes, neutrophils, monocytes, cytokines, and antibody responses that we can come to understand just how miraculously the immune system functions, as well as how it can so easily be set off balance. In fact, the immune system innate to the creature Homo sapiens is so intricately interwoven with heroes and villains, many of whom have the ability to interchange roles within the same scenario, that were it to be dramatized, it would make an ongoing saga that would make a Murder, She Wrote, whodunit look tame by comparison. And it would be physically interactive as well. At the outset, we have to acknowledge the fact that there are actually not one but two different kinds of immune systems in the human body, the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system. The innate immune system comes immediately with the body's born ability to recognize certain hostile microbes and to destroy them. The adaptive immune system is more complex in that the body's genes, cells, and molecules operate in a kind of combinant multiple choice, where the potentials for combination are seemingly unlimited, virtually forming a crazy quilt patchwork of receptor defenses to meet any invading stranger to the system. Being more simply constructed, the innate immune system can usually, though not always, meet and destroy the pathogens to which it is assigned on first encounter. The reason for that is that most villains who enter the human system are immediately identified as antigens. These antigens generally keep a pretty high profile, and because of that are easy to identify, single out, and eliminate. In the normally functioning system, with the continuing array of usual suspects in the form of high-profile bad guys, recognition is quick, arrest is often instantaneous, and there is not as much potential for confusion. This potential is aided by what is called the complement system of molecular selection, where the innate immune system and its macrophage policemen instantly single out which are the good guys and which are the antigen alien invaders, target those for elimination, and virtually destroy them, either by engulfing them and smothering them to death, or literally punching them out. The innate immune system does this in two ways. First, by forming what are called macrophages, a kind of phagocyte that bond to and ingest bacteria through a network of systemic spies referred to as monokines and cytokines. Monokines and cytokines are kinds of operatives, if you will, who actually slip up behind the lines of the antigen and highlight the target so that the mobile monokine macrophage biotransducers, fondly referred to as M&Ms, can issue the final coup de grace to the antigen. The base cells for the innate immune system are called T cells, and though T cells are essential to the survival of the body's immune system, they represent only certain pieces of the intricate immune system puzzle. There are others. Ordinarily, this innate immune system works very well indeed when it comes to coping with myriad invaders. However, particularly in this era of constantly mutating antigens, there are a number of conditions that are either too complex or simply too tough for the innate immune system to deal with. That's where the adaptive immune system takes over. When it does, the game becomes infinitely more involved, adding new permutations to what is already a highly intricate process. To some extent, in our references to the adaptive immune system, we are dealing in hypothesis. And yet, as its functions are revealed, the hypothetical references almost invariably become axiomatic. In the adaptive immune system, the potentials for combination virtually become infinite. So, perhaps understandably, does the potential for complication, body confusion, mistaken identity, and possible harm. The adaptive immune system literally makes new friends and recreates itself in a kind of cellular cloning to bond against more sophisticated invaders, some of which are too cleverly disguised or too strong for the body's innate immune system. This is done by a procedure called clonal selection, a process during which the adaptive immune system cells, called B cells or lymphocytes, manufacture antibodies in an unlimited chain of potential. These B cells or lymphocytes literally ferret out hostile microbes and perform a kind of citizen's arrest, flagging them for seizure and removal by the body's T cell macrophage police force and its complement system. To do this, the T cells and the innate immune system need to build up in degree and number that will enable the macrophages to function in their appropriate search and destroy mode. The AIDS challenge. The need for even more diligent new participants in the immune system game lies in the fact that with hyperpopulations, megacities, and world health crises involving millions on a daily basis, we are being assailed by what might be called new super macho microbes in our environment, in our personal lives, in our cross cultures, and especially in what is referred to as the third world today. There are a number of pandemics that were, as recently as 20 years ago, considered either dormant or effectively eradicated. Still others have arisen that are considered new phenomena in the world of virology. Whether it's the old favorite Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the poet's metaphor is consumption, having resurfaced in epidemic proportions, or the Legionella bacterium, the Lyme disease spirochete, the Rift Valley fever virus, the recently emergent flesh-eating Streptococcus A running rampant in ever-mutating forms in places from Washington State to North Carolina, the kinds of diseases that are cropping up daily to surprise and assault us are increasingly becoming masterworks of nature's perverse ability to confound our immune systems. Recently, outbreaks of the deadly Ebola virus in Central Africa are perhaps merely preamble to the indomitable superviruses that lurk on the horizon. And who is to say what the nature of the next one will be? Nothing exemplifies this latest outbreak of supermutations and muscle-bound pathogenic microbes more radically than acquired immune deficiency syndrome, known by its more notable acronym, AIDS. AIDS, the ultimate virus, the undefeated, unencumbered, non-stop pandemic pale horse of the apocalypse, lurking out there in the consciousness of every cognizant adult as the ultimate terminal censor of their social indiscretion or as the hidden predator waiting in their next blood transfusion, has seemingly pulled the pathogenic coup of the last millennium. Nothing to date, no treatment, antibiotic medication, panacea, or surgical procedure has been acknowledged as even coming close to putting it to rest, much less destroying it. Its reputation is that of the indomitable invader that simply attacks the human immune system, every aspect of it, and devours T cells like Pac-Man gobbles up energy units, leaving the body's immunodefenses so ravaged that other opportunistic diseases can come in almost at will and finish the job, inhabiting the host body with absolute impunity, striking it down with such universally known maladies as seemingly infinite kinds of cancer, lymphomas, and a panoply of skin diseases and respiratory complications that would make the pathologists who's who of the microbial killer elite. This is all accurate in part. It's also an oversimplification of what may be the most misunderstood disease in scientific history. In fact, AIDS is not the virus itself, but the syndrome that represents the ultimate expression of the virus. The original virus from which AIDS emanates, and now almost as infamous as its more popularly known manifestation, is HIV, or human immunodeficiency virus. In fact, HIV is not so much an invader who, like Attila the Hun, rapes, pillages, and plunders, as much as it is the consummate trickster, the super saboteur, very low-profile antigen that hides, disguises, and insidiously sets its agenda, gaining its initiatives cleverly. Step by step, it completely eludes the police patrols of the innate immune system and adaptive immune system until it finally acquires its legion. Then and only then does it strike, surprising the T-cell and B-cell defenders so completely that they do not have time to fortify against it and put it down. Whenever T-cells, and even more so B-cells, expend themselves, they need time to redevelop, to reform, to grow new helper T-cells to enroll in the disease-fighting core. What the HIV virus does so well once it has infiltrated and multiplied is wage a war of attrition against the body's innate immune system, literally wearing it down so that no T-cells or helper T-cells are left to do battle. This takes time, of course, and patience is HIV's strong suit. Since once it is entrenched, nothing can prevail against it. Time is literally on its side. Initially, to be sure, when HIV is first encountered by the body, the immune system mounts a vigorous attack against it. Macrophages and T-cells, T4 and CD helpers, come at the new invader, guns blazing, and actually aren't convinced they have overcome it. That's exactly what the HIV does best. It plays possum for a while, keeping a low profile. Interestingly enough, it is its low-profile antigen personality that renders it so dangerous, so pervasive, and so hard to combat, because despite its continued presence, it manages to confuse the body's T-cell macrophage policeman into accepting it as a normal me, good guy, and letting it stay on. The important issue to understand here is that T-cells only survive and proliferate if they have a job to do, if they have an antigen to arrest and destroy. If not, then they no longer feel needed, and like the worker bee, with nothing to do, simply die off. That's when the HIV really takes hold, because it is gathering new covert forces all the time. By the time the innate immune system and adaptive immune system recognize it again, they are then forced to launch a major assault against an invading force of alarming strength and endurance. This is something for which they are not prepared. Remember, these T-cells and B-cells must have time to regenerate, restore, and recreate themselves. But by this time in the HIV's recognizable stage, the antigen presence is so overwhelming, the T-cells and other helper cells lose all their rank and file, and their numbers fall drastically, literally being destroyed more quickly than they can reproduce. AZT and chemotherapy. First of all, we need to be very specific about one thing. AZT is a kind of chemotherapy. Chemotherapy refers to a general category of drug treatment therapy, almost invariably a highly potent one, administered to severely ill patients who cannot successfully stave off the disease in any other way. True to the allopathic tradition of treatment, the patient or a subject is given massive doses of this chemical drug therapy in hopes that it will find new ways of combining with the adaptive immune system to form new fighters to help the innate immune system destroy, drive off, or at least amend the invading organism. Although chemotherapy occasionally works well, it usually extracts a heavy toll in terms of what it does to the host body. First, the physical manifestations can be severe. Frequent nausea, loss of hair, alteration of personal appearance, swelling of body areas, premature aging, and occasional disfigurement are often the calling cards of this kind of heavy drug therapy. What's more, chemotherapy radically depletes the system of its much-needed nutrients, nutrients that are needed to keep the body healthy and balanced so that its other systems may function properly. AZT, technical name, amiozycolic tryptomycin, is initially less traumatic than most other kinds of chemotherapy in that its side effects and overt discomforts are, on the surface at least, less severe. In view of the incredible debilitating side effects that AZT can manifest later on, however, those initial good impressions are misleading. In other ways, AZT is typical of other types of chemotherapy in that, in the beginning, it does appear to do a good job of bonding with the adaptive immune system and forming a viable wall of defense against the insidious low-profile HIV antigen. If it doesn't succeed in putting it in remission, at worst it has enjoyed the reputation of forestalling the onslaught of HIV and of slowing its rate of growth. On the surface, these initial evaluations of AZT help explain its popularity in the last 10 years as the treatment of choice for suffering AIDS patients. Taking a historical perspective, we feel obliged to note that when AZT was first introduced to the market, the medical community, then in a panic to find something that would work to forestall the onslaught of this dreaded pandemic, sponsored a series of placebo control group tests involving 281 patients in 12 different hospitals. As in all control group studies, the test groups were given the actual medication and the control groups were given a sugar pill placebo. It is important to emphasize here that though the average test time, 4.5 months, was unusually short for any kind of conclusive testing, much less a landmark decision such as the FDA was about to make, it was illustrative of the degree of desperation among medical practitioners to find something, anything, that would make a difference. Despite the fact that the patients on AZT exhibited serious depressions in blood hemoglobin and reductions in granulocyte count, and dosages had to be drastically reduced, AZT was declared the only viable panacea for the deadly new HIV virus. This declaration was based on the fact that during that 4.5 month period, there were 19 deaths from opportunistic diseases in the placebo group, as opposed to only one death in the AZT test group. The FDA, already under tremendous political pressure to get something out there, declared the AZT retrovirus the clear winner among all current drugs then under consideration, and allowed it to be released to the market, along with an accompanying warning list of side effects in fine print that nearly took a full page. At this point, who's to say that AZT was not the right drug for the time? Nothing else had even come close to working, and despite the severely measurable side effects, this retrovirus did make some positive initial impact. Doses were adjusted to more manageable levels, and virtually hundreds of thousands of patients were to be treated with the drug over the next 10 years. At worst, it bought many of them some time, and time gives wings to hope. Nevertheless, the controversy over AZT's benefits versus its side effects rages to this moment. A number of recent studies show that AZT has a profoundly radical bell curve and may in fact do more harm than good. Especially in the latter stages of HIV and fully developed AIDS, it seems the AZT therapy may actually hasten the depletion of the innate immune system's T cells and helper cells and accelerate the demise of the host body. Recent clinical findings, though not yet conclusive, have given early indications that susceptibility to HIV varies greatly, and that if the immune system is built up strongly enough in the first place, it stands far better chance of resisting HIV. The questions, however, remain. Can one ever truly build a resistance to HIV? And once HIV has set in, is there something out there that can arrest it without radical side effects? The answer to both questions is a conditional yes. Prostaglandins, aloe, ace mannan, and HIV. When discussing the immune system, there is a temptation to draw too many players into the game, and though they're important, to add too many tech names to what is already a highly complex mural of invaders and defenders, good guys and bad guys. Nevertheless, we need to add an additional set of elements called prostaglandins into the puzzle. There is now profound evidence to indicate that prostaglandins live in every cell of the body. They are in essence hormones, but ones of such intense personality and force that their impact cannot be denied. As recently as 10 years ago, very little was known about prostaglandins, but since that time, volumes of scientific papers have been released about them and taken measure on their impact on the human immune system. In the first place, there are three major types of prostaglandins known as PGE1, PGE2, and PGE3. And if you view every glass as half full, then they're all set in place to fulfill a positive function. PGE2 prostaglandins make up what we know as the body's alarm system, and for this reason are more than occasionally maligned as bad guys. This is a common oversimplification. What the PGE2 prostaglandins actually do, among other things, are to manifest symptoms whenever something is wrong with the body. PGE1 and PGE3 prostaglandins are considered primary passages to the immune system in that they work through omega-chain fatty acids to actually help reconstitute much of the body's immunodefenses. It is when the body's immunodefenses are strong that the T cells can send out their macrophage policemen to do their jobs properly. In a narrow context, PGE3 prostaglandins are responsible for the buildup of the body's cardiovascular immune defenses, and PGE1 prostaglandins are largely responsible for the immunoefficiency of everything else. Now, it is understood that PGE3 prostaglandins and cardiovascular immunity may be aided greatly and rebuilt to a large extent by the intake of omega-3 fatty acids, known as EPA or eicosapentaenoic acid, that come from deep water, salt water fish such as cod, halibut, herring, mackerel, and even tuna. The best source of those are fish oil capsules or gel caps available in most nutrition stores, whole food stores, and pharmacies. Yes, when our parents forced us to take those awful tablespoons of cod liver oil, they were definitely on to something. PGE1 prostaglandins are a bit more difficult to find sources to rebuild, and it seems a limited number of foods offer the omega-1 fatty acids, such as GLA or gamma-linolenic acid and cis-linoleic acid, to rebuild them. Evening primrose oil and borage from gooseberries and black currants seem to be the most potent candidates. New candidates have also arrived that may be contributory toward the rebuilding of PGE1 outside of the intake of omega-1 fatty acids. Although theories hold strongly supporting these purported omega-chain fatty acid contributors, entirely new roles of candidates have been enlisted as major immune system enhancers and major disease fighters. Everything from shark cartilage and reishi mushrooms to pycnogenol from tree bark and grape seeds, considered the ultimate antioxidant, has been proposed as directly or indirectly contributing to the rebuilding of PGE1 prostaglandins. New protagonists in the immune system's fight against opportunistic diseases such as cancer, various kinds of cardiovascular conditions, and a broad range of other pathologies. Recent developments in shark cartilage therapy in this country point to its ability as a major cancer fighter. And Asian studies in reishi mushroom therapy for both cancer and heart disease have been profoundly successful. All these natural products have received high praise in their abilities as immune system helpers, and just as many detractors who denounce them as being useless and exploitive. No less significant and perhaps more prolific than any have been studies involving aloe vera, particularly as it pertains to its ability to aid the immune system and trigger its effectiveness. We cite a number of studies here in order to define just how significant is aloe's contribution to the immune system, how it has affected AIDS research in recent years, and how profoundly it may affect it in the future. Some of these studies are most impressive, and though some are more completely rendered than others, all offer a great deal of hope to the legions who suffer from this seemingly hopeless syndrome. The Terry Pulse Studies. Terry Pulse was an MD in Grand Prairie, Texas, who later in his career came to specialize in the treatment of HIV patients, and whose reputation as being something of a risk-taker and a bit of a sensationalist both aided and hindered his attempts to make breakthroughs in AIDS research and palliative therapy. Willing to take chances in treating his HIV-positive patients, and having patients willing to try new modalities in their attempts literally to gain a new lease on life, Dr. Pulse began early in 1989 to initiate a series of what were then considered radical treatments. The first one we shall examine was significant because it involved a combination of megadoses of omega-chain fatty acids, GLA oils in the form of evening primrose oil and EPA oils, a potent nutritional drink, and 8 to 12 ounces of stabilized aloe vera every single day. This was a whole-leaf aloe vera gel developed by Charlie Queen and me, the first to be released at that time. All of the subjects were allowed to continue their AZT and other prescribed therapies. And though those treatments varied as to degree and type, there were no interruptions of normally scheduled treatments. In retrospect, we feel it necessary to emphasize the treatments were not truly radical in the sense that Dr. Pulse did not attempt a therapy that was in any way harmful to his patients, nor did it involve modalities of healing that carried with them any measurable toxic contraindications or side effects. Nor, in fact, did he try to act outside acceptable parameters established by FDA guidelines. He submitted his testing criteria along with constituents to be used in the study to the FDA for approval, but was told by the FDA officials that since the products were nutritional supplements and beverages given a GRAS qualification, they were actually categorized as food and as such did not require FDA approval. We bring this up here because the facts seem to elude critics who attempted successfully to pillory Dr. Pulse later in the study. With a specific set of established criteria in mind, Dr. Pulse set up a group of 30 volunteer HIV-positive patients, ranging in degrees of severity on the modified Walter Reed scale, and subdivided them into three groups. Group 1 were HIV 0 positive to 1.9, or early stages of HIV. Group 2 were HIV 2.0 to 5.9, in the ARC or AIDS-related complex range. Group 3 were HIV 6.0 to 14, or fully manifested AIDS. Taking volunteers evenly divided into three groups, Dr. Pulse planned to have patients tested at 30, 60, and 90-day intervals, with final measurements and ratings scheduled for the 180-day termination of the study. Note: the Walter Reed U.S. Government Hospital originally established a means of rating HIV-positive patients on a scale of HIV 1 through HIV 15. Ratings of HIV 1 through 7 referred to patients who were adjudged to be in what are controllable stages of the syndrome, or ARC, AIDS-related complex. In the stages of HIV 8 through 15, the patients are now experiencing the full expression of the syndrome, including radically lower T-cell counts and hosts of opportunistic diseases, many of which have advanced to life-threatening levels. What Terry Pulse found after just a few days was a remarkable degree of turnaround, and out of the three groups into which he subdivided his study, he found the following in just 90 days' time. 5 patients from initial group 3 improved to group 1. 10 patients from initial group 3 improved to group 2. 10 patients from initial group 2 improved to group 1. 1 patient from group 1 improved to score 0 negative. Upon full 90-day examination of the three distinct test groups, Terry Pulse also noted another significant set of developments involving the presence of the AIDS virus in his current list of patients. On a 90-day measurement of P24 core antigen levels, 5 patients have tested 0, indicating an absence of HIV viral activity in the body. And on the Karnofsky quality of life scale, wherein a score of 100 indicates normal activity, 11 patients are now rated at the 100 level. After just 90 days of full day-to-day involvement in this study, Terry Pulse dramatically announced that in 30 cases, all have shown significant improvement. I've seen T4 cells double and triple, and many patients are now able to function and lead normal lives. Having revealed these findings to some nationally acclaimed colleagues, Dr. John Boyer and Dr. Howard Pfeiffer, Dr. Pulse then solicited their review and oversight of the study. Dr. Boyer, an MD and former chief medical advisor for the President's Council on Physical Fitness, and Dr. Pfeiffer, owner and operator of a highly regarded wellness clinic in Bellevue, Washington, also found the quick turnaround in the HIV-positive patients not only to be dramatic but landmark, provided the full evaluation was allowed to run its course. Dr. Pulse, encouraged by professional evaluations that coincided with his own, was convinced that the good news should be shared with the world while the study was in progress. Unfortunately, in the complex world of HIV, 90 days is simply too short a time to declare any study of this kind either bona fide or successful. In the first place, it was neither a control group nor a double-blind study, and therefore would not have passed muster by any system of acceptable measurement. Second, and most important, it was declared a success prematurely and long before final evaluations could be made. Vilified in the press and passed as being something of a publicity hound and pressured to release his initial findings early, Terry Pulse announced the result of his findings both to press and public, and found himself perhaps justifiably in a welter of controversy. Elements of the test were denounced as incomplete, and the press, sensing a profit agenda in the early release of findings, viciously denounced both Dr. Pulse and the company sponsoring the study. In subsequent months, the study became flawed for a couple of very significant reasons. First of all, from pressure by one faction of the product sponsors, the aloe vera was removed as part of the regimen of healing from the group tested. So on that basis alone, the study had to be declared incomplete. Second, because of the overexposure to the press, some of the test subjects dropped out of the test, and a few began to relapse. Most interestingly, however, was the third aspect of this study, and that was the fact that, with the aloe vera removed from the treatment regime, some of the other patients in the group started experiencing less than satisfactory results. Of the 30 participants originally in the study, 3 dropped out. 1 was removed because he had violated the guidelines of the test. 2 others exhibited no measurable improvement. Of the 24 remaining volunteer test subjects, all showed levels of improvement that ranged from moderate to remarkable. All in all, this initial mixed element Pulse study fell into disarray. Yet despite the misperceptions of its intent and purpose, a couple of major hypotheses could be drawn from the initial findings. The first and most significant set out the indication that the omega chain fatty acids, although they exhibited profound impact in helping to build up the immune system to begin with and make it more resistant to disease, including the AIDS virus, might do little to actually reverse the effects of HIV once it was entrenched in the human system. Second, the question had to have been raised. If once the stabilized aloe vera drinking gel was removed as a constituent in the treatment regimen, the therapy started to unravel, then wouldn't the aloe vera merit a study in itself? A third aspect of this study tended to go little acknowledged, though it is consistent of aloe vera in all of its uses as an adjunctive treatment in every pathology against which it is tested. There are no instances in which it appears to antidote or countervalue existing modalities of treatment. And in this study, as in others, neither the whole aloe vera juice nor the omega chain fatty acids exhibited anti-antidoting effect on the AZT or were negatively affected by it. Having recognized the light that failed in what amounted to his second study, Dr. Pohl saw merit in the possibility of testing aloe vera exclusively as a means of treatment, and proceeded late in 1990 with another study, this one using only stabilized aloe vera drinking gel in megadoses of 10 to 14 ounces daily as a sole treatment modality. 30 new HIV volunteer patients agreed to participate in the study. As in the study before it, all HIV patients were allowed to continue their AZT or other standard medications in conjunction with the stabilized aloe vera. This time, the test, though checked after 4 months, was permitted to continue over the course of the next year. Similar in character to the first test, the patient sample experienced 3 dropouts, 1 for personal reasons and 2 who were dismissed for failing to adhere to the criteria of the test. Of the remaining 25, all but 1 experienced moderate to highly remarkable improvement in their test results. After nearly a year's time, 6 were determined to be HIV seropositive. 1 was determined to have gone HIV seronegative with no remaining traces of the HIV. And 1 patient was virtually brought back from a condition of terminal cancer with pronounced tumors to a level of HIV seropositive in a 5-month period of time. All the patients experienced a dramatic rise in their T-cell count accompanied by a diminishment or complete elimination of opportunistic diseases. This time the patients tested continued into a total test period of 18 months, and though there were 2 more dropouts from the test, it was largely completed intact. Dr. Pulse allowed the remaining 23 patients to continue on the aloe vera gel as part of their treatment regime. Once more, due to the fact that there was no control group study as such and no double-blind study, these Terry Pulse tests were deemed inconclusive. In defense of his testing methods and in the name of humanity, Dr. Pulse refused to issue placebos to people dying of this dreaded disease. However, what may have been an act of noble intent in fact proved detrimental to the long-term credibility of the cause because none of the Pulse findings could gain lasting credibility either among his peers or among the scientific community at large. This highly dramatic set of findings by this somewhat controversial doctor was literally given a death blow when Dr. Pulse met an untimely death in Europe in 1993. This unfortunate occasion saw the loss of one of the most valiant crusaders against the AIDS scourge and one of Allah's most ardent spokesmen. The McDaniel-McAnally studies. All this might have been dismissed as merely fascinating and perhaps, that old jargonistic scientific disclaimer, meriting further study, had it not been for a series of equally dramatic and infinitely more verifiable studies sponsored by Carrington Laboratories of Irving, Texas. Those involved the work of 2 men, Dr. B.H. McAnally and H.R. McDaniel, M.D. From 1985 on, Dr. McAnally and later Dr. McDaniel can be credited for 2 major breakthroughs. The first is McAnally's successful isolation of the ace-mannan molecule as what is possibly the active ingredient in the aloe vera complex. Second is a successful determination of the immunostimulating capacities of ace-mannan in high concentrations, both as a part of the aloe complex and as an individual ingredient in treating a number of conditions. herpes simplex, measles, cancer, FLV, feline leukemia virus, and AIDS. So, like aloe vera, its disease-fighting capacities, as affects the immune system, are broad-spectrum indeed. Ace Manin, later registered by Carrington Labs under the trade name Carison, is a mannan or mannose monosaccharide derivative molecule found in the mucopolysaccharide complex of aloe vera. The ACE mannan molecule was isolated and successfully identified by Dr. McAnally as carrying the bulk of the immunomodulatory potential of the aloe vera complex. In all fairness, however, there is much more to the entire mucopolysaccharide complex and to aloe vera itself than can be embraced by any one ingredient. Nonetheless, as the following disclosures may confirm, if aloe vera has a singing sword, at least as far as its disease fighting and its contributions to the body's immune system is concerned, it appears that Ace Manin may very well be it. Initially, Dr. McAnally's attention was drawn to the potentials of aloe and later of Ace Manin through a group of informal and admittedly anecdotal reportings from 8 AIDS patients who seemingly did not know one another and had only the common ground of their consumption of an aloe vera drink to serve as their touching point. However discreetly, these 8 AIDS patients offered comparable levels of improvement in such areas as elimination of fever, lessening of fatigue, and opportunistic infections. These AIDS patients had previously been unable either to work or attend school, yet after 3 to 4 months of drinking the aloe drink, were able to return to normal activity. And it was at this point that Dr. McAnally, a research scientist, turned to Dr. H.R. McDaniel, a respected physician, to evaluate the reports from these patients. By his own admission, H.R. McDaniel was highly skeptical when first approached by his friend and professional colleague, Dr. McAnally. And even after being exposed to the data surrounding aloe vera and the Ace Manin molecule, found them to be questionable. I took a look at the data Dr. McAnally had been compiling since 1985, including the responses he'd been getting from HIV-positive patients, and I still refused to be convinced, Dr. McDaniel remembers. Then, after observing the results and consistency of testing for several months, I finally allowed ego to prevail over logic, and I had to become part of this exciting new research. In 1985, under the aegis of Carrington Laboratories, Dr. McDaniel joined Dr. McAnally in setting up a full-time virology lab largely devoted to the research and development of Ace Manin as the isolated ingredient in the aloe vera complex that most strongly carried its healing potential. Ace Manin was originally isolated and used in experimental wound therapy treatment by Dr. McAnally, McDaniel, and a group of associates in 1985, and found at that time to be highly effective in the production of macrophage, phagocyte cells, to aid in tissue rebuilding. As you will recall, it is the macrophage cells that go about the business of policing for trouble spots in the human system and fixing them. Through the release of cytokine SWAT teams that bond with the T cells and act as triggering agents or whistleblowers to help them locate, isolate, and destroy the invader antigens and convert new cells into good citizens. Shortly afterward, Dr. McDaniel set up a series of 3 pilot studies, the first in 1985, under the full guidance and oversight of an FDA consultant. Following the filing of a treatment protocol with the FDA, 14 AIDS patients were given regular daily oral doses of Ace Manin. In setting the protocol and monitoring the study, Dr. McDaniel was able to observe significant symptomatic improvement in all but the most advanced AIDS patients. Using a combination of clinical and laboratory criteria at 90 days therapy, a 71% improvement in the group was documented. A second pilot group of AIDS patients involved Dr. McDaniel's participation with Dr. Terry Pulse and constituted Terry Pulse's first exposure either to aloe vera or to any constituent of aloe vera, in this case, the Ace Manin product. We note here that Dr. Pulse was one of the first and most adventuresome practitioners on a national level to pursue AIDS treatments on an experimental basis with his patients. Dr. Pulse's fatalistic but accurate appraisal was that these people had been given a terminal prognosis anyway and was willing to pursue any means necessary to help his wards. Apparently, his patients agreed because the roles of volunteers for these studies were very quickly filled. In this 1986 study, 15 AIDS patients were treated with oral Ace Manin. And at the time, Dr. Pulse had neither bias nor exposure to the test results achieved by McDaniel and McAnally in the first pilot study. In the clinical and laboratory parameters established by Terry Pulse, Dr. Pulse noted a broad base of 69% improvement in all the patients after 90 days of the ACE Manin therapy. And in the 29 patients in the two initial pilot studies, helper lymphocyte CD4 levels previously decimated by the HIV virus rose from low levels to normal and some to triple the pre-treatment levels. P24 core antigen levels for the virus dropped or became negative. And patients gained weight, saw their infections subside, and skin test reactions became positive. And of the total group tested, 75% returned to work or returned to their schooling. In a third pilot study, again in 1986, Dr. Terry Watson joined Dr. McDaniel to participate in the treatment and examination of 26 symptomatic HIV-1 patients. That is a large group of nascent ARC patients. Part of the purpose of this study was to establish a pre-treatment prediction of how patients would respond and compare actual results to the criteria and predictions from the first two pilot studies. After a similar period of study, an 87% accuracy rate emerged for predicting who would and who would not respond to treatment. And the large sample of patients indicated, now characteristic, increases in levels of CD4 lymphocytes, reduction in P24 core antigen levels, overall improvement in weight gain and energy levels. These clinical findings, like others before them, were reported to the FDA, who put the orally administered ACE Manin capsules on hold in October 1986, a standard practice by the FDA. Prohibited for the time being from conducting further clinical studies on active patient groups until scrupulous FDA efficacy testing requirements could be undertaken, Dr. McDaniel continued to research the apparent myriad advantages of ACE Manin in positive suppression of the HIV antigen group. In a further study in 1987, Dr. McDaniel and some associates working against the hypothesis that ACE Manin would in fact have some immuno-enhancing capabilities ran a study using virally affected sheep red blood cells to determine just how effective this molecule would be in increasing the release of interferons from lymphocytes. In other words, they tested for the possibility that ACE Manin might in fact be helpful in treating viral infections. Positive results from this study led to further in vitro studies by McAnally, McDaniel, Carpenter, and Associates, which showed that ACE Manin did in fact exhibit strong antiviral capabilities against herpes simplex, measles, rhinotracheitis, Newcastle virus, and against HIV. To be sure, in vitro studies, either in test tube, beaker, or petri dish samples, are impressive, but it is in vivo, or in live subjects, where the true tale of HIV can be best measured. And it is in actual patient application that some of the best results can be found for the healing plant and derivatives from it. By now, the research the McAnally and McDaniel team were doing was making giant strides, and ACE Manin was being examined as a viable adjunct in the struggle against AIDS. Since 1990, Dr. McDaniel has continued in his studies and relentless pursuit of ACE Manin technology. Even today, he continues to be in wonder at the infinite potential this very intelligent molecule seems to exhibit not only against HIV, but also against a host of viral and bacterial infections ranging from feline leukemia virus, FLV, to ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. According to Dr. McDaniel, he has in his findings noted what it is about the ACE Manin molecule that makes it unique. When the immune system is under attack, it sends out these macrophage policemen to find the antigen attackers, to find the damaged me part of the system, seek out the foreign elements, and bond to them. The amazing thing that ACE Manin, and in fact the whole aloe vera complex, does is, when it senses these foreign bodies, it triggers the macrophages to spasm and multiply in geometric progressions, sending a cascade of cellular defense to bond with the T cells and take out these foreign antigen invaders. Working well in the facilitation of the immune system's white cell lymphocytes, ACE Manin, Dr. McDaniel has found, also does an excellent job of allowing the CD4 lymphocytes to normalize. These cells are extremely important in the fighting of HIV, yet Dr. McDaniel notes that ACE Manin works extremely well in helping the immune system fight a number of other opportunistic diseases. The undeniable significance of this lies in the fact that both aloe vera and ACE Manin show highly positive antiviral effects in the combating of a vast array of opportunistic diseases that accompany HIV, and in raising the profile level of antigens so the macrophage policeman can spot them and arrest them.